Donald K. Smith on June 7th, 1984. We're talking in Vilas Hall. I'm Laura Smale, and the interview is being done for the University Archives, University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. This session is going to be about your background and your experience in the speech department, and however far we get along. I'm interested in the influences in your childhood that led you into the career that you had, which would have be your parents or your teachers. Can you say something about that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, my parents were in Nebraska people. I was born in a town which I think no longer exists, called Belgrade, Nebraska. And my father had been a farmer and had then opened a general store in this very, very small community. And my mother had been a school teacher. And she had had some college education, a normal school education, to get her teaching certificate. My father, I think, had only a high school education. But they were both devoted, as many parents were in the early part of the century, to the belief that their children ought to have educational opportunities. So as I grew older, I became aware of how much of their life had been spent in seeing to it that their six children all had college degrees. And as a matter of fact, they moved from Belgrade to Kearney, Nebraska when I was about 4 years old, primarily because they couldn't see how they could bear the cost of sending all six children away to a college or a university. They had sent two of the older boys to Wesleyan University in Lincoln, mm-hmm. and had decided that they really needed to get some place where the children could live at home and go to college at the same time, and Kearney was a possible place for that. So they moved to Kearney, and the rest of us all went to Kearney, what was then Kearney State Teachers College, and became Kearney State College, and is now, I guess, the university at Kearney or something of that sort, State University at Kearney. And that was all because we could go there for very little cost and live at home until such time as we were able to support ourselves. So all of the six children became college graduates, and most of us either went into teaching for a time or considered going into teaching, although I wound up with the situation where two of my brothers, or one of my brothers, was a university professor, then a dean, and then a university vice president at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And I had a sort of similar track at the University of Minnesota. And one of my other brothers ultimately became an MD, and another one became a corporate manager. So our careers dispersed, and my two sisters got married and left teaching after that.
But what in your background, besides their determination that you get an education, leads you to these really distinguished careers?
Oh, I don't know. I think it was mostly the extraordinary importance given to education in our home, to reading, to books, to constant interest in whatever level of discussion was going on publicly about politics or religion, or the issues of the day as they were perceived from the point of view of Nebraska. And I'd say that it was this kind of commitment to education that was always present in the home life. Beyond that, I suppose we were all highly competitive to get ahead in the world, and We just moved in various ways to do that.
What was, say, Kearney, what was it like when you were there?
Well, it was a, I suppose, a very indifferent college of little distinction. And yet it was also a place where the children of people with very modest means in an agricultural state could get a college education. And from my point of view, there were at least two or three professors who had were quite influential. And then also quite influential was the fact that I got active in the debate program. And I found that intellectually stimulating and an enormous source of education, actually. That, I think, has been in the early days of the development of speech departments in this country. Virtually all of the people who went on ultimately to take master's degrees or doctor's degrees in speech were debaters or participants in a very strong theater program when they were undergraduates in whatever college or university they went to as an undergraduate. They became interested in it because of the nature of the activities that claimed their attention and their enthusiasm as undergraduates. And in my case, that was very much a part of the influence. I was also rather oddly interested in the field by a professor of English who had a master's degree in from Harvard University, and who had difficulty with his lungs. It was one of those periods of history, you remember, when tuberculosis was still a very common ailment. I think he had been tubercular and had been told to go into a drier climate and had taken a position in Kearney, Nebraska, where he stayed all of his life. And he was a rather interesting and, I thought, extraordinarily erudite man. He took an interest in me. And when he discovered that I was active in debate and was taking great interest in intercollegiate debate, he assigned me a term paper, I recall, on Quintilian, the Institutes of Oratory, the old translation of the old Roman teacher and scholar in the first century AD, who had written a kind of comprehensive work on the history of rhetoric and the teaching of rhetoric up to that point, and the theories of rhetoric reaching back from Plato on forward. And that was a totally new world to me, and it quite interested me in a dimension of history which I had never encountered before. So these things influenced me. Then my first job, teaching job, I taught history and I taught English. I didn't teach speech. We had another teacher in the school who taught speech, but I was hired for the job because the history teacher who had coached the debate team was going on leave, and they wanted a debate coach. They put very high value on their debate program, so I coached the debate program. And I decided to go to graduate school, and I was a little puzzled as to whether or not I should take graduate work in history or in English or in journalism. I was quite interested in that because I'd been editor of a school newspaper as well, or English. And the man who was on leave, who I had replaced, was finishing his degree at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. So I wrote him and asked him what he would recommend, and he recommended that I come to Iowa City for the summer and take work in the Department of Speech there, which I did. And that sort of got the whole thing started. Those things start quite accidentally in
yes,
lots of ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to comment on what seems to me the mystery of a Department of Speech, which seems so very 19th century, yet mm-hmm. in the contrast with the idea of debating, which is, one feels it's a great loss that mm-hmm. it's not done, perhaps by everybody, but at least by some people.
Yes.
And why they're linked, speech and debating, aside from the fact that one speaks when one's debating.
Well.
But you think of debating as having content, and of a Department of Speech. I realize this isn't true, but I think it's a general notion about it.
It's been a difficult notion. The traditional term, the historical term, which comprehended the theory and practice of spoken discourse, and then inclusively also written discourse, particularly argumentative and suasory discourse, was rhetoric. Mm. And the term rhetoric persisted. In fact, it was one of the dominant streams in liberal education for most of the history of the West. And it was augmented somewhat in the 19th century, a little earlier actually into the 18th, but then quite dramatically in the 19th, by the sort of forerunner to the developments in speech science, and particularly in the art of performance as opposed to the art of persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
Which came in under the, these are very broad generalizations, under the titles of elocution for the most part, also, although there was also early acting theory developed as part of the elocutionary movement. The elocution movement was quite closely linked. Many of the people who were the early writers on the theory of elocution in England were also people interested in lexicography and sort of the beginnings of linguistic science, the development of pronouncing dictionaries and of all sorts of descriptions of the what we would call the symbolism of voice and the symbolism of bodily action and so on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so and meanwhile the term rhetoric fell into disfavor, and I don't want to really go into the history of that. That's very important, and still, in some ways, not totally well analyzed shift in higher education in the West. But in broad terms, it was linked to the rise of science and of positivist or positivistic philosophy. And the distorted but quite general belief that emotive language and kinds of public persuasion that were aimed at arousing audiences mm. was a corruption of the true work of intellect.
Mm-hmm.
So the work fell into great disfavor. Fell into great disfavor, and so when the departments of English began to diminish the role of rhetoric, to emphasize the criticism and study of imaginative discourse, to separate themselves from the study of persuasive discourse, for the most part, not wholly. But largely, you created quite a void in higher education, not only in America, but in most of Western, of Western Europe, with the exception of Germany. The tradition of scholarship and study in rhetoric sort of persisted in the Germanic schools, and to some extent in Italy as well. I shouldn't be quite so casual about these comments. And then, as I've put it, when the departmentalization began to occur in American higher education, the development of departments, new departments, trying to recover elements of a sort of neglected tradition, trying to sanitize what had then become the excesses and superficialities of elocution, trying to provide an academic home for activities that at that time interested an enormous number of students, theater, mm-hmm. Debate, and public reading and all of those sorts of things led to the development of this title, this rather strange title, speech. Nobody ever understood it, although I don't know that they understand any better the term speech communication or communication arts. And so there's
speech
been
is a, at the, least a short word.
Yeah, it's a short word.
So you went to summer school, did you then?
I went to summer school in Iowa one mm-hmm. summer. My debate colleague in at Kearney, who's a transplanted Californian of all things, had taken a teaching job in South Dakota and had gone to Madison that same summer. And I corresponded with him the following winter, and he told me that I really ought to come to Madison, that it was a wonderland. And why didn't we both enroll for the following summer at the University of Wisconsin? He'd had such a good time and found the place so stimulating and enjoyable. So I thought that would be fun, and we roomed together out at one of the lakeshore dormitories at that time, out near Kronshage in that particular area. And I came to summer school then in 1938. After going to Iowa in 37, 1938, I came to summer school at the University of Wisconsin.
How did you finance that?
Out of my teaching salary, I would say indifferently well. I'd waited on tables at Iowa the first summer to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. And by the second summer, I had put together enough savings so that I could ride the train up to Madison and get through the summer session here and get back to Nebraska. And it wasn't very expensive. The fees were quite low. The dormitory rooms were surprisingly inexpensive. Mm-hmm. Railroad fares were quite inexpensive, so it was possible.
Well, you say you went back to Nebraska. You started teaching at Wisconsin High in 1939.
Yeah, I came here in 38 for the first summer. Then I, 38 to 39, I moved. I became principal, high school principal, out in Kimball, Nebraska, mm-hmm. which is out on the western border. In January of 1939, as I recall, much to my surprise, I received a long-distance telephone call from Robert Pooley. I don't know whether you've been acquainted with Pooley or not.
I know about him.
I hadn't known him when I had been here in 38. I had taken work from Gladys Borchers and from Henry Eubank. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for a teacher for Wisconsin High School, and for some reason they had become interested in my vita, my 2 years of teaching at Holdridge, and the fact that I was now going out to Kimball as principal. And they were looking for somebody who could teach, that they thought could teach both English and speech. It was to be a sort of joint appointment arranged by Gladys Borchers and Bob Pooley. He was the methods man or in charge of the student teaching work at that time for the Department of English. Mm-hmm. And he asked me if I was would be interested in taking a job at Wisconsin High School in Madison. And among the inducements would be the fact that I could teach there full time, and I could also go to continue my graduate work and carry on for a degree.
Which you were intending to do. Were
oh
you,
yes, by that time, yeah, I had no, I had no real, I have no recollection of ever having any question of continuing on through to a either the PhD or to some advanced professional mm-hmm. degree of some sort. It just didn't seem to me, it seemed to me to be the natural thing to do if you enjoyed universities, and I did. So I allowed us how I would be much interested. If you had been living out in Kimball, Nebraska in those days, it was not a mind-boggling decision, although it was probably a rather fortuitous one because I was already beginning to get interested in administration, and there was if I had stayed much longer, I might have been trapped into a different line of graduate study. Mm-hmm. So I came back anyway to teach to summer session before 1939, and I taught at Wisconsin High School and continued my graduate studies in speech and education with some considerable work in history at the same time.
So you became, how much were you, well, you weren't a part of the department then, were you, of speech at that time?
No, I would have been a teacher, so-called teacher. I would have been a staff member at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but my classification would have been teacher at Wisconsin High School. Mm-hmm. And I suspect most of us who had that title out at Wisconsin High School were graduate students of one sort or another, advanced graduate students. There were a few people who had had quite long public school teaching careers before they took jobs at Wisconsin High School, and therefore they were sort of veterans who were neither going to be members of an academic department, such as was the case with Robert Pooley, who was a member of the Department of English, and Gladys Borchers, was a member of the Department of Speech, nor were they to be temporary in their jobs at Wisconsin High School. They had stayed on and made careers there as teachers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd be interested in your comments on Gladys Borchers as a teacher and as a colleague at Wisconsin High.
Oh, well, she was enormously influential, she for me. I think I've said on a number of occasions that I believe she was the best teacher I have ever known. She was extraordinary with students of all ages. The 7th graders, the 10th graders, the 12th graders out in the high school. She was equally at home with her undergraduate courses, which I didn't take, but I observed her at times in her undergraduate university courses. I took my second seminar in classical rhetoric from Gladys, which was a surprising area for her to be teaching, and yet it was an eye-opener for me in terms of not only what materials we were dealing with, but the extraordinary sensitivity and skill she had in introducing us. I don't know quite how to put this. There were two influences that I think I pretty directly tie back to Gladys Borchers, which have been extraordinarily influential for me. One was a conviction that the fundamental work of the field of speech had to do with knowledge, and that performance of the sort that we were trying to help people be able to acquire had to be based on understanding, mm-hmm. had to be based on a sophisticated knowledge of communication processes. And that you didn't teach speech as a mere skill, nor merely a skill, mm-hmm. or a knack. You taught students in a way that they would come to understand the process of communication, and from that would understand why you put speeches together in a particular way, or why you conducted yourself in particular ways in certain kinds of contexts and settings. I think I would say today that the early efforts in the field for 10 or 20 years to define and categorize the content of speech processes were rather dead-ended. They were not methods of analysis that were going to go very far, and I think they've been replaced by much more powerful forms of analysis of communication processes at the present time. But it was this conception of the relationship between knowing how and knowing that, in which in the university we were concerned with what it is that you know that teaches you to know how to do things. In other words, the linkage between inert knowledge, or between knowledge and living, and therefore the way in which you discovered and acquired knowledge which would have influence on the way in which you conducted yourself and lived your life. That was a very important idea to me, yeah. She made all her graduate students come to understand that, I think, mm-hmm.
She presented it as her program to when she began.
It was the way she taught eighth graders.
Hmm.
And she showed that children, seventh graders and eighth graders, would be interested in studying about speech as well as giving speeches and taking part in plays and so on. And that I found stimulating. The other thing was she had a faith that I don't quite share, and perhaps am more excessively cynical about. She thought that everyone could learn, and that the real problem with any student was to find out how to teach the student. So mm-hmm. the teaching was a great art, and you were not allowed to say that so and so is too brain damaged or neurotic to be able to learn, or that his or her IQ is so abysmally low that I can't teach him anything.
So this was anticipating the discovery that if you think children can learn, they will, or if you treat them as if they...
Yes, very much so, right. And also shifting somewhat the responsibility for managing the teaching situation upon the teacher. That is, if you're good enough, you'll figure out a way of helping this child in some way. I suppose to some extent I believe that.
You said you didn't quite share it.
Well, I really have encountered students in my life that what I've said about them is that they may have had socially redeeming qualities. qualities, but I couldn't discover them, and that I refused to feel guilty about being unable to accomplish anything with them. Now this, the ironic, or not the ironic, but the sort of unexpected thing about Gladys was at the same time she was very demanding and very tough. She did not tolerate nonsense from university students. And you had on the one hand this almost unlimited capacity to be kind to people who were in genuine distress and total toughness and total capacity to demand from people she thought capable of working harder, being more reliable, meeting tougher standards.
How did she express this?
I saw it when she was working with practice teachers. She would scorch some of the practice teachers in a way that I was happy I had never had to experience in my life.
Verbally,
yeah. Mm. And she would listen to their excuses, and in a voice, just totally frozen voice, she would say, "That's not good enough."
Mm.
And that's totally unacceptable to me. And I want this, to see this happening, and I want to see it happening and not next year, but next week.
And did it work?
Oh, yes. Yeah. She had great respect. Now, if the person were in real distress, really troubled, that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But if she was looking at phoniness or procrastination or sloppiness, the presence of a paper with misspelled words by an alleged university student and or poorly formed sentences, there was no sympathy for that. You know, you were expected to shape up, and it worked, yeah.
And these mm-hmm. people knew how to shape up.
Oh, yes. Well, most, I'm convinced most university students can meet most of the demands we place on them. Not all of them. Some of them do genuinely need a great deal of remedial assistance. But a great deal of the level of workmanship that we have begun to tolerate is laziness. It's simply a student performing below potential or capability.
Hmm.
I've always found that a very useful device. That it's interesting how much writing will improve for so many students if you simply hand back the first paper and say, "This has to be rewritten before I'll even grade it."
Well, you do that, do you?
Mm-hmm.
Is this from her influence,
yes,
do you think?
Yes, mm. I suspect I would have been much more diffident about that before I watched how easily she moved clear across the range of total belief in teachability and a total lack of sympathy with nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Did she, was charm or humor or dynamicness, what was the
tremendous
quality?
Enormous energy, great charm, a good sense of humor, and sort of total dedication. She always had her seminars out to her apartment.
Mm-hmm.
We would, if we were studying Plato and Aristotle in the seminar, she would have us out of an evening to read aloud, sit around in a circle and read aloud one of the dialogues, and then discuss it. And she would serve cake and coffee.
Mm.
And these were very pleasant social occasions. I co-authored a couple of books with her, and she always just drove me almost to distraction with her energy, because you'd give her something to edit, and it would be back so rapidly that you could hardly had time enough to recover your breath. Well, I found out that it was not uncommon for her to get up at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning and start a day's work then, and get in almost a full day's work before the rest of us had got out of bed. And so she had this great drive and great energy.
I wonder why that seventh grade class misbehaved so. She, you know, I don't know that you read her interview. Have you?
No, I haven't.
She talks a lot about her teaching, and mm-hmm. there was one class that she said they were just completely behavior problems, all of them. And for instance, she asked for volunteers to do something, and only one of them was willing to do it. And then at the end, I guess they voted to continue the another semester. I don't know quite how that would work in the seventh grade. But you say she was a good teacher with seventh and eighth grade.
Oh yes, yeah.
She was, but they loved her, or they.
They were very fond of her, and she. She was resourceful. She had great resources. I suppose, like every teacher, she remembers bad classes or difficult classes or difficulties that she worked with and couldn't quite overcome. Could I be excused just a moment?
Yes.
All
right. Yes.
Go ahead. Did you have in mind a particular line of?
I'm asking you whether there was some naivete in her approach to research, and
I think it's fair to say that there was a great deal of naivete in the whole field in terms of research, a great deal of devotion to research, but a difficulty in coming to grips with the processes as complex and, in a sense, as inaccessible. The processes of communication. Mm. Now, in all fairness, if you ask about the intellectual environment of the early part of the century and down into the 20s, you could make the same statement about many of the fields at that particular time. For example, in retrospect, behaviorism in psychology seems to me naive, and yet it was extraordinarily dominant at Harvard and in the universities across America in the early part of the century, or at least if it did not dominate, it was certainly a contender for domination.
Mm-hmm. So they weren't any more so here than.
Than they would be. No, the field of psychology, which was a relatively new field, which has become an enormous spreading empire of research. In its early incarnations, particularly in quantitative research, seems to me we would now consider to be quite primitive in its approaches to research problems. Maybe it still is, maybe we all are, but because those are the kinds of research tasks we set for ourselves, other than the critical and historical tasks, are quite complicated. Quite difficult to control. I thought she gave a great deal of attention herself to the differences between oral and written style. Mm-hmm. And I thought that as I went further in my own studies, that this is a fundamental misconception about the relationship between language and behavior, that the differences we perceive in samples of discourse taken in oral settings and discourse responding in writing to allegedly similar sorts of settings, that these are functions of much more complicated sets of relationships between the varieties of ways in which we symbolize things, and that it, as a line of research, it was dead-ended. It was it could go so far, and then it could go no further. Which I think is a pretty good description of what happened to that particular line of research.
So it wasn't just her. Others in the speech department would have been equally, seemed so perhaps naive.
Yes,
from a
actually, I was startled to find a very distinguished University of Michigan linguist who was, it seemed to me, re-examining the differential behaviors in spoken and written language in the 1950s. And his reputation was enormous, and his erudition was enormous, but it seemed to me again that he'd picked up a line of study that was not going to be particularly productive. And I suppose we could go through the history of research, especially in the social sciences, and the quantitative research carried out in the social sciences, and we could discover an enormous number of lines of research that turned out to be sterile.
Yes, I suppose in the sciences as well.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think that's true, yes.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just that she's a woman who is working terribly hard, clearly overworked. She makes a statement at some point. She's talking about O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
And tried never to promise anything that he couldn't deliver. And then she says there were many times you wished he would say he was going to try to get something.
The department was grossly overworked. And that was true when I was a graduate student in the department, and I think to some extent it has remained true today, although not quite so conspicuously. I've described the department as developing as a teaching field, and as the move took place through the planning of the field in universities such as Wisconsin and Cornell, and then in another more complicated historical way at Northwestern, and about at the same time in Iowa, the effort of the faculty both to develop research programs, graduate programs in research, and to maintain these enormous activity programs, and to teach a large number of very extraordinarily popular and yet time-consuming courses, that this kept the field spread very thin. There were lots and lots of efforts, and I was still participating in some of them in the 40s and 50s, to find the intellectual unities in the department. Those unities probably exist in some very abstract level where we talk about symbolic behavior and all of its manifestations and forms. But the course of history since the 1930s and 40s, when I came to Wisconsin, has been for the large departments to begin fragmenting into a number of small departments. For example, my doctoral program at Madison was absurdly eclectic, although oddly enough I don't regret that. It was it's been sort of valuable to me to be spread so thin and to know a little bit about so many things. Although it's also been a limitation, but I took work in speech pathology and speech correction. I studied what was known about linguistics and linguistic theory, phonetics, phonemics, physiological, acoustic, and I was introduced to then the burgeoning new and thrilling field of semantics, and this carried me back into the new developments in philosophy, which were speaking to the nature of meaning, the meaning of meaning and whatnot. And I was studying argumentation, argumentative theory, and introductory symbolic logic. I was studying classical and medieval rhetorical theory and contemporary rhetorical theory. And I was studying English literary, the development of literary criticism in the English field. I was studying theater, directing, play production, radio and radio production, and the early studies of mass communication, mass propaganda, the influences of this is like trying to comprehend half the universe of learning.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Was this a typical curriculum for a graduate student?
Well, part of it would be, the other fields would be typical. The amount of reading you did and where you carried it was would vary greatly depending upon how much interest you had in the bibliographies and the associations with other fields.
But you were expected to take two such
we were examined in pathology and speech correction, in rhetoric and public address, in the history of public address and oratory, in theater, and in mass communications. Our prelims might cover all of those areas. And now, of course, theater is a separate department.
Mm-hmm.
Communicative disorders, as they call it, is a separate department. There's mass communications is sort of divided up between schools of journalism and some studies exist in psychology and political science and here and there, and then in the so-called what we now call telecommunications in the communication arts department. And the newcomer has been film, which has developed sometimes in communication arts departments, as at Wisconsin, sometimes elsewhere in other universities. So the processes of specialization did not control the development of the department in its its initiation and early years. Very eclectic field, reaching out in all directions. And they didn't begin to really begin to take place until after World War II.
Did you ever consider changing your field?
No, it was a fascinating field. Everett Hunt, who, by the way, this is quite an aside, he just died. I saw last...
I don't know his name.
Well, he was a Cornell PhD in rhetoric, as they called it, rhetoric and public address. And then they renamed their department to speech. Mm-hmm. He was a classical rhetorician. The Cornell people followed a less eclectic course than the Wisconsin people and specialized quite heavily in historical and critical studies of the field of rhetoric, and also in joining those two, studies of classical languages and classical literature. Hunt started in life a little bit as I did. He was somewhat older than I was, but he was educated in a very small state college out in South Dakota, as I recall. Was a debater. Went back to graduate work at Cornell University, took his degree there, I think under Winans or Witch Elms, I'm not sure, maybe Witch Elms, and taught for a time in the field. Then he became dean for the last part of his career. He was dean of Swarthmore, which is, of course, a very wealthy and very tony Ivy League college. And lived out his career there as a dean. That's a long introduction to a comment that always tickled me. He said, speech is an excellent field for graduate study for restless young people who can't make up their minds what they're going to study when they grow older. Because he said, you move in so many different directions, you can ultimately decide whether you want to be historian or critic or scientist or what have you.
That's what it sounds
mm-hmm.
like.
Mm-hmm. Or director or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. I never regretted it at all. Mm-hmm.
You took courses in history, too.
Some. I didn't. I did a lot of history as an undergraduate. I had a joint major in history. And I didn't have anyone here. It was a very great history department. I don't recall anyone in history that I worked with who was particularly influential. Mm. I took some courses in English. I was impressed with Miles Hanley. I took a course in phonetics from him. I think mostly impressed by his overweening ego. He was he was not only a great lexicographer, but he was not reluctant to let this be known. And I took courses in education. I did my prelims in French and German, but I did all of that on my own. I didn't study in the departments. I had undergraduate French minor, and I simply whipped myself in shape in French, and then I used a tutor to make a sort of temporary conquest of the German language.
Mm-hmm. I've just been interviewing a few people who were in the 50th, coming back for their 50th reunion of the class mm-hmm. of 1934. And one of the questions that one always asks people who were students then, and especially you in 1939, was how conscious you were of the development of events and how it affected your view of your future?
In you're talking about the political
the
events, the war, yeah.
Mm.
I had been, as an undergraduate, quite active in, oddly enough, in the Kearney, Nebraska branch of the Oxford
Were
movement,
you?
Yes.
That's interesting. I'm interested in that. Most people don't seem to have heard about it.
I recall one of my history professors, we had weekly convocations of varying sorts for the entire student body, or I think everybody was supposed to go, and most of them came. The
mm-hmm.
college was still small enough so the entire student body could get into the auditorium. And one of the sessions in 1936 had to do with a panel discussion on the rise of Nazism and the threat to peace in Europe. And I recall at the time we had a great deal of interest in the rise of fascism and Nazism, and great distaste for it. But I think shared the general impression in this country that Hitler was a sort of clown, and that the good sense of the German people would prevail, and there wasn't that much threat. I believe both Roosevelt and Churchill deserve credit for catching on much earlier than many of the political leaders of the day and many of the intellectuals of the day as to the very serious threat that might be posed by Adolf Hitler, although Churchill, of course, was friendly toward him in his in the early 30s, and it was a sort of latter-day awakening that caused him to become so violently anti-Nazi. And at any rate, we were active and interested politically, but I don't think we saw much threat of war. And when I made a one part of my talk in that particular panel was a sort of tribute to the absurd dogma of the Oxford movement, that if just enough of the young people of this world simply announced to the political leaders that if they have the stupidity to declare war again, we will refuse to go, that we will have a period of peace in the world. I thought about that a good deal when I went into the army, and not so much wondering why I had changed my mind, but wondering why I had been so naive about political processes and about the flow of opinion and the flow of power in the world as I had been in my college days.
But what about 1939 on then, when you were a graduate student here?
I followed the war. I always read public affairs and took a great deal of interest in current history, and I think it was only through my subsequent studies of Roosevelt that I became fully acquainted with the dynamic processes which were carrying the United States closer to an actual war. At the time, I think I would have not believed that there was any really imminent threat.
Even yeah. in 1939,
no,
you didn't?
No, I didn't perceive that the Japanese would ever risk a confrontation with the United States. That seemed absurd to me. And I didn't perceive the enormous danger that I didn't think I perceived fully the enormous danger that Hitler posed and how tenuous England's situation was. I would have supported Roosevelt. I was a great admirer of Roosevelt's. I would have supported the Lend-Lease bill mm-hmm. and the arsenal of democracy concept and of helping the British stand fast and giving them logistical and munition support, but I hadn't really considered that we were to be launched into a world war so precipitously.
And what about the Spanish Civil War? Did you pay any attention to that?
The Spanish Civil War occurred while I was in Kearney.
Must have seemed very remote from Kearney.
No, oddly enough, if one talks about the penetration of leftist ideology in the United States during the 30s, and even the penetration, I think, of the Communist Party at the time. Of course, we have since become startled by how many intellectuals and how many artists and whatnot were not only strongly leftist in their sympathies, but the significant number of them also became members of the Communist Party in the 30s. We had a young man, see, Kearney's a very small town, a young man named Quigley, who volunteered in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and went off to Spain to war. We had another young man named Martin who followed him the next year. And I knew Quigley. I had two friends at college, two other Irishmen. One of them, They were both the sons of people who worked on the Union Pacific Railroad. One of them was named Hartford, and the other one was named Gallagher. And they had wonderful names, and they actually wrote a newspaper column for me when I was editor of the college newspaper. Suddenly, Hartford announced to me one night, as we were sitting around chewing the fat, that he and Gallagher were going out to California, and that he had decided to become a member of the Communist Party and go out and work in the party out in California. And Gallagher, who was a much more amiable and sort of tag-along young man, he went along with him. Gallagher came back in about a year. I never did see Hartford again. I don't know what happened to him. He said Hartford had left the party, though, and had become a Zen convert, and that he had never joined the party. He said that he had decided after the first two meetings that it was totally boring and nothing he wanted to have anything to do with. So you see, you were not immune to those influences, even in the middle of Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. You knew there was a teachers' union here at the UW, to which TAs belonged also, so you would have been eligible. Did you join in?
Oh no, I
did. You know about it?
I didn't even know about it. I was not a TA. See, I was a teacher.
Yes, I guess.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, I was not a
Walter
teacher.
Walter Agard and Jim Early and Elizabeth Brandeis mm-hmm. were some of the faculty who were
no.
in it.
I was never, oddly enough, I was never a teaching assistant here.
No.
I was
okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well.
I see.
My memories of the department are extraordinarily warm, and the people I became very well acquainted with, of course. course. The chairman of the department was Andrew Weaver, who was a much more dignified and remote figure. And I took a good deal of work from Henry Eubank. I grew very fond of Henry, who after yes. whom his room is named. And I took work from Robert West, who was an intellectual, eclectic, who was head of the speech pathology and mm-hmm. speech correction wing of the department. Gertrude Johnson, who was famous for the strength of her character and her demanding standards on oral performance, and some of the people in theater, Fred Berkey, Rusty Lane, who went to was head of the theater at that time, Harold McCarty, in one of Henry Eubank's courses, we did our laboratory work down in WHA, and Harold was, of course, one who introduced us to it there. And I actually had some sessions with, I don't think he remembers it, with the man who's now my neighbor, Jerry Bartell, who was then the program director for WHA, but left the university shortly thereafter to go into to commercial radio. And then just before I left, after the war, I took a course from Fred Haberman had come. And I took some coursework with Fred when he came here as a new professor, new young professor, and later, of course, he became the chairman who succeeded Andrew Weaver. I think Fred was an extremely significant figure. He remained one of my closest friends all the time I was at Minnesota. I became chairman of the department of Minnesota, and he became chairman here. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that Fred, in many ways, supervised the transition of this department from an extraordinarily eclectic, very vital department devoted to scholarship, but not really able to focus it in an intensive way. Mm-hmm. That he conducted the change that turned it into a rather formidable scholarly department. And now that I've rejoined it, I'm impressed by the enormous level of expectation and erudition that goes into the graduate work and into the dissertations, as so many of us who got our degrees, I think, in the 40s and or did most of our work in the 50s. Have said we probably could not have passed the preliminary examinations that we're now giving or met the demands with our dissertations that are now being placed on the students that we're responsible for. And I suspect that may have been true of a number of fields, but it's certainly been a very dramatic shift in this department.
See, Haberman came in about 1948, was it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. He came just the year before I think I left, 47 or 48. And I took a course, a couple of courses from him actually that year before I went to Minnesota.
So you were still a graduate student, but you're called an instructor, or you do on your curriculum vitae in education.
When I came back after the war, I didn't go back as a teacher at Wisconsin High School. I became an instructor in the College of Education, generally supervising practice teachers, some of whom worked at Wisconsin High School, and also conducting laboratory sessions. We were instituting some new wrinkles after the war on the teacher education, and I was part and parcel of that.
Mm-hmm. I didn't really mean to get off into that, but I wondered if you were familiar with the operations of the speech department under Andrew Weaver's chairmanship, what kind of a chairman he was.
I would not have been a member of the department. I knew only of Andrew only through the coursework I had, through the fact that he was always very, very kind to me, and I actually then participated in the, along with Andrew and Gladys Borchers in writing a book on the teaching of speech. Mm-hmm. That was the first book I think I participated in writing, and I was much flattered when Andrew and Gladys, who had collaborated a number of earlier works, invited me to join them in writing a methods book in the field. And so I got acquainted with him in a social way that, and in a kind of a collegial way that way, but I would not have been a participant in the department at the time.
Mm-hmm. He presumably brought Haberman here.
Yes, he brought Haberman. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He also indirectly probably influenced my return to Wisconsin.
Well, I wondered about that. It seems logical.
Well, when I went to Minnesota, his son, John Weaver, was a professor of, young professor of geography.
Mm-hmm.
And John, I think at Andrew's behest, after I think the very first year I was there, invited me and my wife over to dinner at their house. Hmm. And so we that was really the first time I became acquainted with John and Roberta, and we saw each other periodically. John, because of his associations with other members of the department through his father, knew most of the members of the speech department in Minnesota, and was actually a neighbor of the chairman of the department, E.W. Zebarth, at that time. So I had a sort of ongoing social relationship with John while he was in Minnesota before he left.
Mm. You hadn't met him here. I thought maybe you had gone out to Weaver's house for...
Oh, I may have met him, but I'm not really aware of it. Mm. I just was not... I don't really believe I ever met him or met Roberta until I went to Minnesota.
Was there a social life in the department in the late 40s? And were you part of it?
At Wisconsin?
Yes. Mm.
I was... here was one of the major changes that occurred in the... between the 30s, the late 30s and early 40s. And I think... was a change that still had not occurred when I came back after the war. I'm not conscious that the change occurred before I went to Minnesota in 49. In the 30s, and from my reading, I judge in the 20s as well, the big push on graduate study in the department took place in the summers. The department had a very large number of graduate students who came, who were teaching, either in colleges or high schools, and who came back for graduate study in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
The students were older, they were more mature, they were most of them experienced teachers. The faculty was heavily augmented in the summer with visiting professors. And we had, I didn't live in the tent colony. We had large numbers lived in the tent colony out along the lake. And they had wives and children. And then we had, I remember every summer, a departmental picnic. And it seemed to me that by the time you had gathered all of the graduate students, the wives and the children, there would be upwards of 150 or 200 people at these affairs. They were huge affairs. The courses were large and were mostly graduate courses. In the winter, the graduate program was quite restricted. Not too much offered, and there were not very many graduate students in residence other than the teaching assistants. They would be here, some of them, but most of the teaching assistants would also be older people. They were people who had gone on leave to try to finish up their PhDs. Now, the summer session is almost empty. We teach some seminars. We have a few of our PhD candidates and master's candidates are here finishing up or taking a seminar or two or teaching for us in the summer. But the majority of them are students who have come to us immediately out of their college, their undergraduate preparation, or have transferred after their master's degree. And they're they're much younger. And most of them have, the only teaching experience they have is the experience they'll get with us here before they go out and take positions.
And you think this change occurred at the end of the 40s, maybe?
Yeah, I think it occurred, I think it began to occur when the huge pressures of the post-World War II enrollments began to boom. You see the very enormous growth that was taking place between 46 and 50. Mm-hmm. And I think the pressures on the department then became such that they couldn't sustain both the pressure that was present in the winter session, the winter terms, and what they'd been accustomed to doing in the summer. Moreover, there was another kind of change that was taking place, which I've referred to as specialization, and a very general change occurring in the university on residency requirements. The university was very careless about its residency requirements. You could fulfill, when I came here, fortunately, you could fulfill your residency requirements by putting together a sufficient number of summer terms.
Yeah.
Plus, just your single seminar or something during the winter. Now you really have to be a full-time student for 2 years in our graduate program. So it's quite different. It might be interesting to go back and talk a little bit about the reputation Madison had in the late 30s, part of what brought me here, but only part, and indeed it was only part, I think, of what caused the enormous popularity of Madison summer sessions at the time. It might be interesting to talk about that
too.
A little bit. Mm-hmm.
I got the impression that your friend's description was a physical life here.
Was a wonderland.
Yes.
And it was even a wonderland, it was certainly a wonderland compared to Iowa City.
Mm-hmm.
We lived, as I've said, only a few feet from the lake. We had a dock. You could rent canoes. We were within walking distance of the tennis courts. And it seemed almost a vacation land for a Nebraska resident to come here in the summer. The university had a glowing reputation as the most innovative and forward-looking great university in America. I suppose partly because of my political liberalism and the way I'd been caught up in all of the advanced thinking of the 1930s, I would have been acquainted with the fact that Wisconsin was a luminous university, but it was not staid or high collar. And I had known about Meckeljohn's experimental college before I came here. We had.
How did you hear about that?
I think I did a paper on it actually. When I was an undergraduate student, I believe it perhaps was flourishing before
it's 1936. It ended in 1932. I think it was.
Yeah,
like
so it would have been earlier. Yeah, I think I think I may have done a paper about it. I found that there was a considerable. When I got here, I found there was a considerable gap between the romantic image that one got from the literature of it and some of the realities which had been encountered by the professors on this campus. They were a good deal more jaundiced in their view of what took place, and it's accomplishments than I had been. I was much taken, however, by that kind of image of the university, and I, when I got here, I was, I found quite exciting. I found the Capital Times quite an exciting newspaper. The aggressive and robust political life of the state and the entertainment of listening to William T. Evue on the radio with his gravel voice and of reading his columns in the newspaper and his editorials. I was distressed when I got here and began to learn more about the sort of the ragged record of political conflict between Phil La Follette and Glenn Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Frank had been a person I admired from his writing and his reputation. The La Follette name was a much more luminous name to me then than maybe closer acquaintances made it in some ways. But the whole progressive movement, progressive party, had always interested me a good deal, and I had been an enormous, I'd been enormously devoted to George Norris in Nebraska, Senator Norris, and had thought of him along with La Follette as part of that. Independent little band that voted against World War One, and but then when I discovered that Phil La Follette was had devoted himself night and day politically to getting the president of the university fired, I wasn't terribly charmed with the ruthlessness of state government at that particular time and the sort of intensity of the political interactions between the campus and the state.
Did you ever look into that further?
I've read the history. All I've ever done is I've read through the Gray history, and then I've read a good deal about the progressive movement and about starting back with Bob La Follette and the development of the split in the Republican Party, and then the development of the Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota, and the development of the Progressive Party in Wisconsin. And then the very curious move. I really haven't studied in depth that sudden bid on the part of Phil La Follette for national attention, the effort to found a third party in the 30s, which
There's a bit about that in the archives.
Is there? Yeah, I'd like to look into that sometime. I've spent quite a lot of time on Father Coughlin and Huey Long, and on Floyd B. Olson in Minnesota. And indeed, I got acquainted with some of the old farmer labor people in Minnesota, and then I was around for the transition into the Democratic Farmer Labor Party that was engineered under Hubert Humphrey. But I've wondered if a little more probing of what seemed to be sort of the symbolic affiliations or affinities that the abortive effort undertaken by Phil LaFollette had with the trappings and propagandistic features of Nazism.
Well, it did. Yes, that's what.
If that might not make him an interesting figure to feed in along with the other radicals of the 30s who, in a sense, formed a variety of pressures that Franklin Roosevelt had to contend with. I don't know. I'm just speculating about it.
The little bit I've seen is correspondence with Lloyd Garrison, who was dean of the law school then.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, though.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
But
you were aware of it at the time.
Yeah, I was aware of it at the time, and I was fascinated by the kind of energy of the university. It just seemed to me to be intellectually alive in all ways, and I found that very attractive. I think in lots of ways it's remained that way.
Hmm. Oh, yes.
Yeah. We could finish up in just a few minutes then. I commented on the reputation Wisconsin had as a people's university. Its energy, its innovativeness, its willingness to experiment. At the same time, when I got here, I found all of the professors, both in my department and in other departments, very accessible. I was never conscious of any...
That's a point to make.
Yes, I was never conscious of any difficulty in going in and talking with anyone, or even going to confer with people I scarcely knew about some problem. It seemed to me a very friendly place. But there was also a curious sense of... style in the community that startled me just a little bit. The addiction to full dress dances after military ball and the other social functions that would take place in the evening. That so many of the faculty and students wore full dress suits, white ties, and that they wore black ties and tuxedo coats to dinner or at gatherings that started either at 6 or before 6. And so it almost seemed that to be stylish in Madison, Wisconsin, you had to have access to a tuxedo and also a full dress uniform. And I did not at the time become terribly aware of it because he'd passed from the scene, but people spoke about Glenn Frank as one who wore striped pants in the whenever it was appropriate. I guess that was in the morning or something. Or anyway, he would wear one outfit in the morning, and then afternoon he would change to a different outfit, and that he entertained with great ceremony and a great deal of attention to so-called social graces and whatnot. I found Minnesota, I think, genuinely, really more democratic than Wisconsin in that respect. There was, it seemed to me, in the social life, a good deal more informality and a great deal more relaxation about attire and the formality of the attire. Now, of course, that has occurred in Madison as well.
Yes.
Since that time, but this was in 1949 when I went there. I found it agreeably, what shall we say, a people's university in that respect.
But your own Kearney hadn't gone in for long dress balls and proms?
Oh, we had proms, but the notion of renting a tuxedo to go to a prom, I think, was quite beyond our both the resources of the people who lived there. I don't know whether we could even have afforded one. It was hard enough for me to keep one suit in operation that I could wear in the evening. The women wore long dresses at the proms. They were always in formal attire, and the men wore neckties and a variety of forms of coats. And I guess occasionally I can recall seeing somebody in a tuxedo and thought they looked terribly pretentious and whatnot.
But you had to wear one if you went to one of those dances here.
Well, you were very much out of, I don't know if they would have thrown you out, but you almost felt as though you would have been persona non grata if you hadn't been in formal
so
attire.
So did you go to them?
Oh, yes. I went to all of them, and in fact, I was very fond of attending the social functions, and I rented, and actually I purchased after I became a little more affluent. I bought myself a dinner coat, not so that I could get the most of them that way, but I actually would rent full dress suits for some of the ones where that was quite stylish. And I was quite pleased at Minnesota that I could allow my dinner coat and my tuxedo to grow green with age and not be much disturbed. There were few opportunities to wear one there, although there were places where you could. Seldom required, however. It was the difference between the campus was dead on weekends. The city and the town of it was not such a city at that time, and the campus were totally alive here all through the weekend. At Minnesota, things sort of rolled up at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, and the library was open and people were in their laboratories and so on, but the students, 60% of them or 65% of them were commuting from someplace, and they disappeared. So the so-called university community was much smaller, even though the university itself was larger. Then the faculty here has dispersed to a considerable extent. It was much more assembled in one or two locations at the time I was here. At Minnesota, the faculty was sprinkled all over the city and all through the suburbs. I lived in an area quite close to the campus. There were a considerable number of faculty there, but there'd be no place in the city that you could identify as a heavily dominated by faculty, except something we called the University Grove, which was a faculty housing area maintained by the university itself, and exclusively faculty. So the tonalities and the ethos character of the two universities seemed to me quite different. I'm not sure I had a great deal of preference for one over the other. had great affection for Madison, and I still do. I developed great affection for Minnesota and for the Twin Cities and the sort of wealth of cultural opportunities and activities in the metropolitan area there. But they're both public land grant universities with pretty much the same profile of colleges and educational opportunities, both very large, and yet you get really great differences in the temperament of the campuses, I think, from stemming largely from the difference between a commuter population and a very heavily resident population.
Is there such a legend about Minnesota as there, or myth as there is about Wisconsin, the notion of the Wisconsin idea and this sense that it's...
No. The Wisconsin idea and the great national and international prominence that Wisconsin achieved actually way back in the 30s was not being replicated at Minnesota.
So there was a genuine difference there.
One
gets the feeling that talking only to Wisconsin people that perhaps it isn't the only place in the world there might be others.
Well, it isn't the only place in the world that has a statewide extension service or that regards the boundaries of the campus as the boundaries of the state and so
on. Some people will comment that it seems a little provincial to talk the way.
I think it's there are forms of community chauvinism operating in both Madison and Minneapolis, however, and
so Minneapolis has its share.
It's the university is perhaps a little less chauvinistic than Madison. The community is if anything even more chauvinistic.
Mm.
When Guthrie decided to found the Guthrie Theater there, and I had dinner with him and Frank Whiting, the director of our theater at Minnesota one night. Frank was very active and had become quite well acquainted with Guthrie, and he asked him, he said, why, you know, there were lots of places that were trying to interest the founding of the theater in their community. Milwaukee was after it, and Detroit was after it, and Cincinnati was after it, and I think Washington or Seattle, maybe the West Coast. Frank said to Tyrone Guthrie, he said, why did you choose Minneapolis? And he kind of beamed, and he said it was incredibly the most chauvinistic city I had encountered. He said the people here, he said, have such overweening confidence that this is going to be the arts center of America. That he said, I was simply, I said, whatever else Minneapolis is, it's the place to build a theater. Mm. I think he was quite right. It's supported it very well. Mm-hmm. So there was great intellectual and artistic chauvinism in Minneapolis, and that more or less in some ways dominated the university.
It was a city there.
It's a city there, and the university is a city university, and here. It's the university that dominates Madison, the university and state government.
Mm-hmm.
Those are simply some sort of interesting feelings about the temperament of the two places.
Mm-hmm. Well, shall we stop here?
I think that's a good place to stop.
All right.
I've been.